Okay, well, let's take our Bibles and in the Old Testament be turning to 1 Samuel chapter 29. Lord willing, we're going to look at chapter 29 and perhaps even beyond it this evening. We'll see how that goes. But we are coming down near to the end of this book. But remember that 1 Samuel is one book in our English Bibles, but in the original Hebrew text, 1 and 2 Samuel would be a single volume when the Old Testament is translated into Greek, because Hebrew does not use vowels in the same way that in written vowels in the same way that other printed languages typically do. But Greek does. When we translate this book from Hebrew into Greek, the size of those books doubles. And so some of these books, Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, as we term them, were all split in two. So chapter 31 is not the end of the end of Samuel, but it is the end of 1 Samuel as we have it in our Bibles. And it seems a fitting breaking point that, Lord willing, we'll talk about in the next week or two. Tonight we're going to look at chapter 29, though, and I want to begin by reading the text in its entirety as we kind of parachute back into the text. Remember that the latter chapters of 1 Samuel are not advancing chronologically. Instead, there is a pattern that the writer is using where he's alternating episodes between David and Saul. And it's flashing back and forth like you might see in a modern film technique, right? He's flashing back and forth rather than just telling one story in its entirety and completing it. He wants you to see the juxtaposition of the king that is under judgment and the king that God is now calling to power. In 1 Samuel chapter 29, David is hiding among the Philistines. He is under the care of Achish, the king of Gath, one of the five city states of the Philistines. David and his men are living in the town of Ziklag, and he has been conducting raids against the enemies of Israel, but has been lying to Achish about the targets of those raids, claiming that it is in fact against Israel and her allies, and lying to Achish about his allegiance with regards to the Philistine-Israelite conflict. We'll see how that backfires on him in these two chapters. Pick up in chapter 29, verse 1 now. Now the Philistines had gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the spring that is in Jezreel. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years? And since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day." But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David, of whom they sing to one another in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Achish called David and said to him, "As Yahweh lives, you have been honest. And to me it seems right that you should march out and in with me to the campaign. For I found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not approve of you. So go back now and go peaceably, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." And David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king?" And Achish answered David and said, "I know that you are as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He shall not go up with us to the battle.' Now then, rise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who came with you, and start early in the morning and depart as soon as you have light." So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, but the Philistines went up to Jezreel. I want to show you one thing very quickly. If you look back at the end of chapter 29, you'll notice that that chapter concludes with Saul and his men departing, and it was night. Chapter 29 concludes David and his men departing, and it was early in the morning. It was light. That's part of that juxtaposition that you're seeing. You're seeing the king who is under wrath, and the king who is now under God's favor. I've made reference several times in our study of the historical literature of the Old Testament to the little commentaries by Dale Ralph Davis, a PCA pastor who's written on each of these books. Very readable, very helpful little works, and find a lot of use in what he says. I don't actually interpret this chapter in just the way that he does, but I love the title that he gives to this chapter. And he uses the title, asking the Philistines to be your Lord and Savior. And I think that that is a great way of capturing what has gone on in David's sojourn with the people of Gath. He has sought the Philistines as his Lord and Savior. And I think it is much to his shame that he has done so. I think this is a completely understandable move. I think it's natural for him to feel that he cannot continue to survive for long as a fugitive in the wilderness, that he's basically run out of hiding places, that even the people of Israelite cities are prepared to betray him and hand him over to Saul, and that there's just nowhere else he could go. I understand that the military strategy that I think David has in mind here that we'll talk some about in chapter 29, and for all that, I think it was a mistake. And I think one of the ways that you see that it was a mistake is to see the consequences of those lies and of that hypocrisy in chapter 30. But to get to chapter 30, we've got to get through chapter 29. So the Philistines and the Israelites are encamped, prepared for battle. This is the battle where Saul is going to die, as we learned in the last chapter. He goes to the witch at Endor, fearful because God is not replying to him anymore. And Samuel's spirit comes up and says to Saul, by this time tomorrow, you will be in the dead, in the grave, among the dead, in Sheol with me. Now, the lords of the Philistines are passing in review, preparing to go out to the battle. And remember what we said is that the Philistine people is a loose confederation of peoples. In fact, in certain respects, like the children of Israel were for 300 years from the invasion and conquest until the time of the monarchy, we said that they were kind of tribally organized and that each tribe had its own leaders and each region had its own judges. There was not a central government. Well, that is the way that the Philistines operate, although they have a little bit more structure to it. The Philistines are led by the kings of five city-states, and the leaders of those city-states exercise influence over the rest of the territory that belongs to the Philistines and all of the people that are there. You remember that Ziklag was a city that was under control of Achish, the king of Gath, yet it was many, many miles away. And that is much to David's advantage that Achish says, listen, why don't you go with your men and occupy Ziklag? And that allows David the freedom to come and go on these raids without being immediately under Achish's nose, as it were. He's able to do things more covertly in that way. As the Philistines are passing in review, all of the troops are being mustered and the kings and the commanders are there and they're looking at their men and looking at their forces. And then along come Achish and his men. Right at the back, here are the men of Gath. And yeah, there are our favorite soldiers under Achish's. And who is that? They recognize immediately there are Hebrews there. And the commanders of the Philistines say, what in the world are you doing? Now, Achish comes across like a country bumpkin in this chapter. Davis does in his commentary highlight the fact, something I had not noticed quite honestly before, that the Old Testament does consistently kind of portray the Philistines as, in a bit of a buffoonish way. They are frequently treated as kind of simple-minded, and that's partly because they're the enemies of Israel, and that's kind of the assessment of them in light of God's favor toward Israel. But Achish has just this very, you know, naive response. And in fact, the way that he responds probably doesn't help his case. If you notice verse 3, he says, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel? Well, that's probably not what you want to remind them of right now, right? Yes, indeed, it is David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel. David, one of the significant warriors and commanders in Saul's army. And yet Achish says, well, he's been with me for a long time now. Days, years, been so faithful, haven't found a thing wrong with him. I trust him completely. Verse 4, the commanders of the Philistine army are angry with Achish. Now, you've got to understand the structure of the nation. There is not a central government. The kings of the other city states don't know that Achish has had David within his territory for quite some time. And they certainly didn't know that he was about to bring David and his men as a mercenary force into this battle. Now, in this case, I think the other Philistine commanders show a lot more sense than Achish is manifesting. As they point out to Achish, verse 4, how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord, would it not be with the heads of this men here? How can David ever go home after being with Achish and being a resident of the territory controlled by the city-state of Gath? Well, bringing the heads of the Philistine commanders and kings on a platter back to his homeland, that would do it. That would do it. I think there is every reason to believe that that is David's plan. We'll see that in the latter part of the chapter. Is this not David, of whom they still sing in dances? Even the Philistines know this song, right? They probably hate that song, but nonetheless, because it's about them. Achish calls David, and it's just, you almost feel sympathy for Achish as he's saying this. Because he comes across as a man with more integrity than David, I think. Now, maybe I'm misreading it. That's not the way that all Old Testament commentators read this text. And so maybe this is my misreading because of my biases, but I think this is much to David's shame that there is a pagan who uses the name of David's God in praising David for his integrity, and all the while, we the reader know David has been anything but honest. Verse 6, as Yahweh lives. That's not Achish's God. That's David's God. And he is paying homage to David and to his God. That's how much he loves this man. That's how much he trusts this man. It's sad to see how thoroughly Achish has been fooled. As Yahweh lives, you have been honest, and to me it seems right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign, for I found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. And I think he means it. I don't think there is any deception in Achish at all. He really hates the fact. David was going to be a secret weapon. And by the way, if David had gone along with this, well, you know, David would have been the most effective warrior on that battlefield. David is worth 100 Philistines on the battlefield. He is a remarkable man. And his men, worthless fellows though many of them are, and we'll see that again in the next chapter, they're very good at killing people and breaking things. They're mercenaries, you know, and not missionaries, mercenaries, right? And you can imagine, Achish hates to lose that weapon. This is my secret weapon. This is my ace in the hole, right? The city-state of Gath, our forces are going to win honor at the battle this day. Nevertheless, the Lords do not approve of you, so go back now and go peaceably that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. Now, some commentators, including Davis, will read this as kind of David breathing a sigh of relief. I think that's the wrong way to read it. That could be correct. I think David tries to talk him out of it. He says, but what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my Lord and King? Who is he talking about? He's not talking about Saul, and he's certainly not talking about Yahweh. He's talking about Achish. He is flattering this Philistine king. To what end? To try and convince him to let him go with them to battle against the Israelites. Now I want to ask you, maybe David is simply trying to maintain his cover by protesting, all the while hoping that Achish is not going to relent and actually take him. Maybe that's the situation. That's the way many people read it. But I don't think so. I think David was hoping that this is how it would work out. I think this is what was in his heart when he first went to Gath, is that if he could ingratiate himself with Achish, with the Philistine forces, that there would come a day when he would be invited as a mercenary to go to battle with them, and he would be the fifth column behind the line. And I think the rest of the Philistine commanders have read David correctly, that this is going to be the way that David returns home. Is he is going to assassinate the Philistine leadership. He is going to cut down the Philistine forces from behind. He is going to be the double agent. And I think that's why he's protesting at this point. Could be wrong. Maybe we're reading too much into it. Achish answered David and said, I know that you are as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. I mean, that just, you know, you just cringe when you read that. Not hardly. Again, I realize that sometimes people read narratives like this and they say, well, David's deception is justified because it is in the context of war. That's not how I read the Old Testament. That's not my understanding of the ethics of this situation. I think David was wrong. And I don't believe, as we saw in 1 Samuel chapter 16, that a believer is obligated to tell everything that he knows about any given situation to an ungodly person. So this whole idea that anything less than the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth is a lie, that's not a biblical definition of lying. But what David's doing is lying. He has lied over and over and over and over. And you can say, well, I think it's justified in the context of war. That's interesting. But I'm not sure biblically how you would justify that, except by appeal to examples in narrative. And remember, that's not how narrative functions. Narrative is telling a story. It doesn't necessarily tell us whether God approves or disapproves. Sometimes it does explicitly. More often, it simply tells us what happened. And we have to look at the consequences, and we have to judge the character's behavior based upon the explicit revelation of law. The explicit revelation of law seems pretty clearly to be on the side of don't lie. And that's exactly what David has been doing for a very long time. Achish says to David, verse 10, "Rise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who came with you. Start out early in the morning. Depart as soon as you have light." I think it's possible Achish is concerned that the Philistine commander's not going to let David leave. "You need to leave as soon as it's light." And David indeed does so. I really have to get into chapter 30 to be able to apply chapter 29. So let me go ahead and read the first part of chapter 30. "Now when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negeb and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives also had been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, 'Bring me the ephod.' So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. And David inquired of Yahweh, 'Shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them?' He answered him, 'Pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue.' So David set out and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Bezor, where those who were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and 400 men. 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Bezor." Now, you've got to be careful of doing the very thing that I warn people not to do in narrative, and that is to infer in kind of a dogmatic way what God's attitude might be about something that he doesn't actually tell us explicitly based on something else in the text. But I think what you just saw is God chastening David. I think that's what you just saw. I don't think it's a coincidence that while David is dozens of miles, 60 miles if they're mustered in Gath, while David's a long way away from home with all of his men, I don't think it's a coincidence that while he is carrying on this campaign of deception for some greater good as he perceives it, his family suffers the very kind of raid that David has been practicing for some time. What's the fundamental difference? Nobody dies. Do you know how weird that is? Nobody? No one was killed? Surely somebody would have been killed. Why not? Is it because the Amalekites are compassionate people? I mean, we know biblically and historically that just the opposite is true. That's not because they're compassionate people. That's one of the reasons I think this is divine judgment. I think this is divine chastening. I think this is God getting David's attention and saying there are negative consequences when you are not walking according to truth. When is the last time that David inquired of the Lord? We're in chapter 30 right now. Last time was chapter 26. It's been a long time. There is no mention of David seeking counsel from God during the time that he is sojourning with Achish and Gath. Now, don't misunderstand me. This is not an argument from silence that says, therefore, David did not pray, did not worship, did not inquire of the Lord. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the text is silent about it. And that silence may be significant. That there is a contrast here. That during the time that David is sojourning with the Philistines, he is seeking from them his salvation. Here is my security. He's not having to ask the Lord, what should I do? Where should I go? How should I conduct myself? He doesn't have to do that because he's with the Philistines. And with the Philistines, he is safe. But now, God puts him into a position where he has no security. His family has been taken. His men are ready to kill him. Why would his men be ready to kill him, do you think? Do you think that all of them thought it was a good idea to go play nice with Achish? Do you think that all of them thought it was a good idea to pretend to be loyal to the Philistines so that they could be this fifth column action behind the enemy lines? Or do you think that some of them were saying, you know, we're a long way from home and our wives and kids don't have any protection out there. And there are nomadic bands, we're one of them, that conduct raids against villages like this. And they come back and they say, this is exactly what we thought would happen. And this is on you, David. This was your idea. This was your plan. And look at where it has led us. You can imagine what they're saying. How many of them want to stone him? We don't know. But all the people, the text says, were bitter in soul. Because their kids have been taken away. They don't know if they're going to see their children again. Now, I don't want to be guilty of overstepping the bounds of what's actually revealed, but this sure looks like the kind of thing that God does when he disciplines one of his children. Mm-hmm. It certainly gets David's attention, because what does David do next? Something we haven't seen him do in quite a little while. Verse 6, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. In the Lord his God. He draws closer to Yahweh in an hour of need. This is what we pray for, that God would do for us. That when God finds it necessary to correct us, that he would do so as Jeremiah prays in Jeremiah chapter 10. Correct me, O Lord, but in gentleness. Right? Not in your wrath, lest I be swept away. Don't destroy me. Don't crush me. But do what is necessary to get my attention. The psalmist will pray, let the righteous strike me. It will be a kindness. Let it be like excellent oil upon my head. Let my head not refuse it. Right? This is what we pray, is that God would do what is necessary in our lives to draw us closer to him. The problem is sometimes what it takes is God has to take away the things that we are trusting in. However brief. I'm not suggesting that David's an idolater. I'm just suggesting that that trust in the Philistines kind of looks like idolatry. It doesn't mean that he stops trusting in Yahweh. It doesn't mean that he stops worshiping Yahweh. But you know what David starts doing when he gets back to Ziklag? He starts praying. He starts praying. He can't rely on his cunning here. His military strategy is worth nothing at this point. By the way, you, the reader, get to know that it was the Amalekites that made the raid, verse 1. There is no reason in the text, until they find the Egyptian in just a few verses, there's no reason to believe that David has any idea who did this, where they went, how far he's going to have to chase them. They don't know if they're ever going to see their family again. And he's not going to find any comfort from his men. His men, at least many of them, hold him personally responsible for this. Where are you going to turn? You know, where could I go? But to the Lord. Somebody ought to write a song about it. And that's what David does. And then verse 7. He begins to do what he's able to do. There's a lot that he can't do. He can't undo his dishonesty. He can't get a do-over on what I consider to be a serious mistake with regard to the Philistines. But here's what he can do. He can call Abiathar. And he can seek the counsel of God, the blessing of God, through the priest that God has appointed. You have a priest, by the way, greater than Abiathar. You have a high priest who is sinless. You can approach boldly the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in our time of need. And that's what David does. He goes to the throne of grace. He says, bring the ephod. We've got to talk to God. He inquired of the Lord, verse 8, shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them? This is a remarkable question because I would have thought that's not the question David would have asked. That the question David would have asked would have been, which way do I go? How many days until I catch up to them? I mean, this is David, who in 1 Samuel chapter 25, when he is insulted by Nabal, tells his men, everybody get your sword. By tomorrow morning, every man in that compound is going to be dead. David's a warrior. He's a man who has blood on his hands, in both righteous and unrighteous ways. Look at the humility. If you're in David's sandals, are you asking God, should I go after them? Of course you should go after them. This is what you do. I mean, this is what God made you to do, is to fight battles. And if there has ever been a righteous battle to fight in David's life, the battle to rescue his wife and the children of his men, that's a righteous battle, right? But look at the humility. Should I go? Why do you think David's asking that? Let me offer a suggestion. You think that David is not trusting his own judgment anymore? And that's a good thing? That maybe David is having a crisis of confidence in a good way? He had this great idea. Let's go to the Philistines. Let's convince Achish that he is my Lord and King. Let's convince them that we are willing to turn against Saul. Let's draw this out. Let's convince them that we've been fighting against the Israelites for some time, and then there will be an opportunity. Well, there is a way that seems right unto a man, and the end thereof is death. David's great idea ended up seeing the city of Ziklag sacked and his family taken hostage. And so the first question he asked God is, do you want me to go? I think that's the right question. And God says, yes. Not only do I want you to go, I want to assure you, you're going to catch him and you're going to get everybody back safely. This is the difference between God disciplining children and God judging reprobates. When God disciplines his children, it is not without hope. It is in gentleness. It is for the purpose of restoration. When God judges the reprobate, it is for their destruction. God is very compassionate here. I think God takes David's family away. How else can the Amalekites take David's family? But God says, you're going to bring all of them home. And so here we go. This is one of the most exciting chase scenes in the entire Bible, right? David and 600 men, and they are running after those Amalekites. So hard, so fast, that 200 of the men are spent. They can't go any farther. How hard would that be, by the way? I don't know whether these 200 men have families that are among the hostages. Presumably, some of them would. I mean, that's a pretty significant portion of David's force. That's a third of his men, right? Presumably, some of them would. How exhausted does a man have to be on a mission like this to say, I can't go any farther? They're not saying that just because they're a little tired and they want a longer water break. They are exhausted. What does that tell you about how fast and how hard they're moving? Right? This narrative is not, it doesn't dramatize this. It doesn't draw it out. But you can imagine, right? If we made a movie out of this chapter, this is one of those great scenes, where Aragorn and the merry band, are going across the plains and they are running for days, right? That's David and his men. Verse 11. They found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David, and they gave him bread and he ate. They gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. And David said to him, "To whom do you belong? Where are you from?" He said, "I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid against the Negeb of the Cherethites and against that which belongs to Judah and against the Negeb of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." And David said to him, "Will you take me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band." Well, that was lucky, right? Just a coincidence. Why did that Egyptian servant get sick? And for that matter, why didn't his master kill him? Why did he leave him alive to die and run the risk? I mean, you got to think about this. I don't know. But what do you think that David's men's wives are saying to their captors right now? Don't you figure that there's at least one really sassy woman in the group that's saying, "Do you know who we are? Do you know who our master is? You just wait. David is going to come and get you." How hard are the Amalekites pushing? No, they're pushing pretty hard. This servant was left behind 3 days before. No food, no water, very sick. Takes him 2 or 3 verses to revive, right? Enough to answer the question. His only request of David is, "Don't kill me and don't give me back," because they would. And he says, "I'll take you down to them." And folks, there's no coincidence in that. There's no luck in that. This is God's providence. When you are inclined to demand of the heavens, "Why, O Lord, why would you allow something like this to happen? Why would you allow the enemy to come and to sack the city, to burn Ziklag, to carry my family away?" You just remember, the same God that allowed that to happen is also the God who is using that for David's good and who is providing for this pursuit and eventual victory. Verse 16. "And when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight of the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his 2 wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, 'This is David's spoil.' Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Bezor. And they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near to the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, 'Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that each man may lead his wife and children and depart.'" Lead away his wife and children and depart. "But David said, 'You shall not do so, my brothers, with what Yahweh has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike.' And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, 'Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of Yahweh.' It was for those in Bethel, in Ramoth of the Negeb, in Jatir, in Aror, in Siphmoth, in Eshtemoa, in Rechal, in the cities of Jerahmeelites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Hormah, in Borashan, in Athak, in Hebron, for all the places where David and his men had roamed." I think the Amalekites have gone a long way We don't know exactly where they intersect, and not all of these places that are mentioned in texts like this are we able to definitively place on a map. But the Amalekites, they're pushing hard. Remember, David wears out 200 men. Now, granted, they had already been over at Gath, and so they're tired from that journey, and they haven't had any rest. They probably haven't slept for several nights. Okay, but still, 200 of David's men, and we now find out some of them clearly do have family among the captives. They can't go a step farther. David has been pushing hard to catch up to this band. The Amalekites had left the Egyptian servant behind 3 days before. Why are they pushing so far? Why are they running so hard? Perhaps because they know who's coming. But they get far enough that they believe they can relax. And when David catches up to them, they're all spread out, drinking, dancing, singing. And David and his men walk in. Do you notice David comes with 400 men? And just get this. It says, no one escaped alive except 400 men. Now, what's the significance of that? Oh, is there some theological symbolism there? Not that I'm aware of. I think what's actually you're meant to take from that is David and his 400 men are badly outnumbered. Badly. If the text says everybody was killed except those little 400 over there, then the 400 is the minority. And it's David's whole group. And it doesn't matter because God is with him. God leads David to victory. What do you take from that? I think one of the things you take from that is to say, David, if we've read this text correctly, found himself in quite a pickle and his family in harm's way because of his own foolishness and sin. And when you find yourself between a rock and a hard place because of your foolishness and your sin, you may feel like there is no recovering from that. You may feel like, I can't call out on the Lord. I can't cry to God for help. I can't hope that God will spare me because, after all, I did this to myself. I'm here because of my own stupidity. Yes. Yes. And this is one of the places where the Psalms would help us. The Psalms show us, Psalms that David wrote during the aftermath of his sin, where he prays for God to be merciful and where God shows him that mercy. And this is one of the places in his life where we can see that very thing. David's family is put in harm's way because David was so wise that he did not appear to need to seek the counsel of God. And he justified a lie. And it backfired on him badly. And he humbled himself. And he strengthened his hand in God. And he sought counsel from the Lord, even to the point of asking, should I even go after this group? He submits himself completely to God in the questions that you wouldn't even think he would ask. And what does God do? He restores everything. That's amazing. God doesn't always do that. God won't always do that for David, by the way. Later in David's life, he's going to sin in ways that are going to cost him for the rest of his life. And will cost his family. But in this story, isn't it a blessing to see that even when you have created conflict and problems for yourself and for other people because of your sin, that you still have a Father in heaven who loves you and who will listen to you when you humble yourself and repent? That's a blessing. That's a blessing. This story has a happy ending. We don't have to say, wow, because of your lying and your stupidity and your foolishness, then everybody was lost. No. Nobody was lost, as a matter of fact. In fact, at the end of the story, David is sending from his spoil to other leaders from among the Israelite people in the southern region of Judah, and it doesn't hurt to share with them the wealth. By the way, the Amalekites have raided some of those territories, right? So this is in part compensating them for losses that they have incurred. But it certainly doesn't hurt for a man who has been staying among the Philistines for quite some time to show to them that I am still loyal to my people. I know who my people is. I know who my God is. I'm not on the side of the enemy. And I'm ready to come home. Guess who is going to be the first to welcome David home? The men of Judah. All right? And that's not a coincidence either. If I could share one thing with you real quickly and then we'll close. This is a quote from Davis's commentary. And he's commenting on verse 23, and I thought this was an excellent observation. When the wicked and worthless men come back to the brook and they say to the 200 that it had to stay behind, "You're not getting any of the rewards of this victory." You know, spoil is the way that you fund warfare in the ancient world, right? I mean, this is the pay that we get, okay? And you can have your family, as many of you as have a wife or children or whatever, that's fine, you can have them, but you're not getting any of the spoil. The booty belongs to us who actually fought in the battle. Well, that sounds kind of reasonable, except that it's coming from wicked and worthless men. I want you to notice the contrast. Verse 20, what are the people saying about everything that they've captured? This is David's spoil. Look at verse 23. But David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what Yahweh has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us." See the two different perspectives? David's men say, "Look at what David's done." Now, earlier in the chapter, they were ready to stone him. Right? Now they're celebrating him again. "Look at what David's done. This is all David's spoil. These are his winnings." And David says, "This is God's. This is God's gift to us. Yahweh gave us this. Yahweh preserved us. Yahweh granted us the victory. And you're not going to be selfish with what doesn't belong to you. It belongs to God." Listen to what David says. He says, quote, "What Yahweh has given us dominates David's thinking and controls his decision and action. So grace must always be the decisive and dominating factor in the Christian's practical theology. He or she must constantly confess that this success, this employment, this loved one, this health, this meal is what Yahweh has given us. What do you have that you did not receive?" 1 Corinthians 4:7. Every Christian then has no choice. You must be a good theologian who both speaks and lives a theology of grace. You will find it humbling, but it is the only thing that will keep you from worshiping yourself. End quote. I thought that was worth mentioning.